Well, good morning. We're in the book of Exodus, beginning chapter 17 this morning. My approach to the text this morning is a little different than what I normally do. And you see on your outline, I have Exodus 17, 1 to 7, and also 1 Corinthians 10, 1 to 12. And I should have put on there John chapter 6 and John chapter 4. We're going to be looking at all of those texts. Sounds like we're not going to have much time to talk about them, doesn't it? But we're at chapter 17. That rock was Christ. Chapter 17, beginning with verse 1. Then all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped in Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Just 2 weeks ago, my sermon, I believe, was on the same issue, no water to drink. Verse 2, therefore the people contended with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. So Moses said to them, why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord? And the people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses and said, why is it you have brought us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, what shall I do with these people? They're almost ready to stone me. And the Lord said to Moses, go on before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel. Also take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock in Horeb. And you shall strike the rock and water will come out of it that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. So he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah because of the contention of the children of Israel and because they tempted the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? We'll stop there with this morning. For some reason, it has always amazed me when I read through the historical narrative of the children of Israel coming from Egypt to Canaan, and see how all of the great things that they witnessed, see all the miraculous things that they partook of from God's hand, and yet how quickly they turned against God, how quickly they would murmur and complain and gripe, even blaspheme the God who delivered them. And I tend to think, how on earth could you do this so quickly? I would suspect, if I were to examine my own behavior, I've never went across the wilderness from Egypt to Canaan, but I've gone through life, and I've experienced God's blessing a lot. And if I were to look at my heart and my situation and my actions carefully, I might find that I'm not so much different than these people than I think I am. I might find that I tend to gripe and complain every time I get a splinter in my finger or whatever the case may be. That I forget God's goodness. Fear and hunger, real hunger and real thirst are powerful motivators for us to do something, to find some relief. And these, the children of Israel, in a circumstance where their only relief at times is going to come from God's hand, God's miraculous hand. So they gripe and they complain. That's what our text is about. Now here we're going to take a different approach, like I said from previous weeks, because these things we're going to be hitting on regularly as we go through the book of Exodus. And this morning I want to talk about, for a little bit, about types. And in the Old Testament, particularly, there are things that theologians call types. And I want us to, if you see on your outline, I've got four or five different things that are similar terms. But I wanted to make the distinction between these terms and talk about them just for a little bit, because we're going to see them regularly. We saw them last week with the manna. So let's look at what we've got here, a type. A type, you can read along on the outline, is a branch of biblical interpretation in which an element that is found in the Old Testament prefigures one found in the New Testament. The initial one is called the type, and the fulfillment is called the antitype. They can be a person, a thing, or an event. Now, the next sentence is kind of put together by biblical scholars who practice interpreting Scripture. And their statement is this: the safest way to approach types are to limit them to those specifically mentioned in the Bible. In other words, just because Moses has a rod doesn't mean that rod represents something in the New Testament. Just because Moses wore sandals doesn't mean that sandals represent something in the New Testament. Okay? For us to view it as a type, the safest approach is to limit those things that we call types to ones that the New Testament says are types, clarifies that for us. For instance, we'll see, perhaps it's in Exodus, maybe in Deuteronomy, a little further along here, where God sends serpents to as punishment upon the children of Israel. And they're biting them and dying or getting sick or whatever the case may be. And for a cure, God tells Moses to do what? Take a bronze serpent and lift it up on a pole, and whoever looks upon the pole will be healed from the snake bite. Right? Well, in the New Testament, Jesus, and I think he's talking to Nicodemus, if I remember correctly, makes this statement. Even as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so also must the Son of Man be lifted up. So there you see the type spelled out for us. Right, last week John talked about the manna, eating the manna. If you still have an outline, and I meant to bring one with me and I forgot it, but his outline from last week, the last two sentences on his outline, if you have it, read it. This will be the next to the last one, a paraphrase, that the manna was a type that was found in the Old Testament. Its fulfillment was Jesus in the New Testament. Okay? There are other types. The Passover lamb obviously is a type. Okay? So this safe approach kind of gives us a little safety. That's why it's called a safe approach, right? However, there are things that seem to, and we'll be going through some of them as we go through the ritual law here, the ceremonial laws we go through chapter 10, that seem to clearly could point to Jesus, but maybe it's not spelled out in the New Testament. So this is not a hard, fast rule. All right? You see some other examples there as well. The last sentence under those types there: caution should be taken in going beyond the one element prefigured by the type. Now, let me show you how that can lead to absurdity. Last week, John told us that the manna was a type of what? Christ. So we say, okay, the manna is a type of Christ. So let's apply the manna to Christ. They picked the manna. If they didn't eat all that they picked in a day, what happened? It soured and stunk. Stank. I'm from the South like you were last week. So how do we apply that? Well, you get too much of Jesus, it stinks. Is that how you apply that? No. Okay, so you don't apply every little detail about the manna. You find the one point, and that's it. All right? Okay, that's a type. This is perhaps the most complex, the most weighty of these names, of these terms here that we're going to look at. This is perhaps the most weighty one of all. The second is an allegory. An allegory spiritualizes biblical history. Now, the reason this is in here is, for one reason, a warning. And for the second reason is because this word is used one time in the New Testament as listing an allegory for us. And here's the example. The example would be law and grace represented by Hagar and Sarah. Paul uses it that way in Galatians chapter 4, 22 through 21. Now, this next sentence is my own. So you take it or leave it. The use of allegories is not a legitimate way to handle the scripture. Now, I'm not saying Paul is wrong. I'm just saying don't make it a practice of doing this, particularly when you're preaching. Because you can go anywhere with that. All right? Let me give you an example. This happened to me 30 years ago or so. Me and a friend of ours, if I remember right, we went home, ate Sunday lunch with them, and went back to church Sunday night. And that afternoon, we were sitting around talking. We were talking about this very thing. And very thing we're talking about. We go to church that Sunday night, the danger of using Scripture in an allegorical way. Went to church that night, and lo and behold, they had a guest speaker, a missionary coming through, going somewhere, and he preached that night. And his text was in the Gospels somewhere where, you remember the story where four guys brought a man to Jesus, and they couldn't get in the house, so they cut a hole in the roof and let him down by the roof. That was his text. Now, I don't remember all that he said, but I do remember this. That those four guys who let him down through the roof. The first guy represented faith. The second guy represented obedience. Third guy represented this, fourth guy represented that. And I knew, I thought, oh my, here we are. We just talked about this afternoon. And I knew what was going to happen as soon as church was over. This guy is going to make a beeline to me, and we're going to talk about it again. And sure enough, he did. He said, well, what did you think? And I said, well, I think that's just what we're talking about. There's nothing in that passage that gives you a reason to let one guy represent faith. Sure, he needed faith. I need faith. But that's not the way you come up with a sermon. Most people who use the scriptures in an allegorical way do not believe the scriptures. They do not believe. They'll make an allegory with Adam and Eve, but they don't believe Adam and Eve ever existed. This is not the way to handle Scripture. You can take any nursery rhyme or Aesop's fables and make a sermon that way. Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow. You could preach a sermon on that, couldn't you? Right? An allegory, that's the second. The third one is a figure or figure of speech. The example that's given in the scripture, or one, is in Hebrews 11, where Abraham says his faith was seen and that he was willing to offer Isaac as a sacrifice. Being confident that God would raise him from the dead wherein it says, as a figure or in a manner of speaking, he had already received him from the dead one time. How was that? Because he was and Sarah were too old to have children. Their bodies were as good as dead, and yet God gave them this son. So a figure of speech. The next one is a parable. A parable is a short story usually told to illustrate a single point. Notice those two words, single point. A given amount of material, now this is an important sentence, given amount of material must be inserted into the story in order for the story just to hold together. All right? But not every item in the story is subject to interpretation or subject to be a part of the point of the parable. Again, it's like the type. You figure out what is the point of the parable, and there is the limit to which you go. The most elaborate, that's probably not a good word, the parable that Jesus told, were at least the most explanation that he gave to a parable, perhaps was the parable of the sower. The sower went forth to sow, four kinds of ground that he sowed upon. You remember that story? Jesus goes later on, gives the explanation for the parable. But that's by far the most explanation he gives to a parable. People understood the parables, even Jesus' enemy. You remember this parable of the wine dresser, where the owner of the land went off into a far country, left his land to some people to farm it. And he sent a messenger to see how things were going. They killed him. Does it two or three times to kill him. He said, I'll send my son. Surely they'll respect my son to see how things are going. They kill the son also. At the end of the parable, at the end of the story, the text says that the Jews and the Pharisees, I believe it says they took up stones to stone him. At least they were mad. And they said this, or the text says this, because they understood that the parable was spoken against them. So a parable makes a point. And then the last one is a symbol. A symbol is a timeless sign referring to the past, present, or future. Whereas the type always foreshadows a future event. The type is always in the early, looking at in the past, looking at the future. A symbol can be either way, back and forth. Symbols are found in many prophetic books, such as Revelation, as well as the modern church's use of the cross, the little fish symbol. All of these things are symbols that represent something. The last statement is significant there. Symbols are always inferior to the things they symbolize. I'll never forget when I learned that item there, that statement. We were listening here at church a number of years ago to R.C. Sproul's video series, Foundations. And it was toward the end of it, he was talking about eschatology, talking about prophecy. And he mentioned a term that's in the book of Revelation, the lake of fire. And he asked, is this literal? Is there really a literal lake of fire? And I always want to take everything as literal unless I have a good reason not to. So I'm thinking, yeah. And he said, I don't know. Revelation is a book that is full of symbolism. Full of symbolism. So there's symbolism in this book. He says, however, if this is not a literal lake of fire, then remember this, it's something worse. Because a symbol is always inferior to that which it symbolizes. So ever how awful and how torturous you might envision a lake of fire to be, if that's a symbol, then it's only worse. It's not better. Okay, so there's those terms. We're going to be going through the book of Exodus probably for another year or so. We're going to see those terms, particularly the type, over and over again as we go through. So those types will be hopefully pointed out and pointed, help you point to what they represent. This morning, here is our type. The type is the water. The type is the rock that was used to give the children of Israel water. How do we know that's a type? Because in the New Testament, it tells us so. So let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. We'll look at this. First Corinthians chapter 10. Verse 1, Paul says, "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual food, all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ." So here in these four verses, the Apostle Paul gives us three or four types. He identifies three or four types that we have been covering for the last month or two. Notice what he says. Look at the terms followed by or preceded by the word all. "I don't want you to be ignorant," he says, "of our ancestors, things that happened to them, because all of them were under the cloud." The cloud was a type. All of them passed through the sea. The sea, in a sense, was a type, perhaps a weak type. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. We'll talk about that in a second. All ate the same spiritual food. What was that? The manna. So there's the antitype for what John talked about last week as the type. Verse 4, all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them. What rock is that? It's the one in our text today, for one. And he tells us the antitype. That rock was Christ. So there is the connection between the type and the antitype. A couple things I just want to mention because the word is there. Notice you see that word, the spiritual rock that followed them. You ever wonder what that meant? Okay? It could mean that in our list, this rock, the mention of the rock, follows the other things that are mentioned. See what I'm saying? It follows his mention of the spiritual food, meat. It follows his mention of the cloud and the sea. They drank of that rock that came next in his list. Okay, that could be what it means. And there's nothing wrong with it meaning that. Okay, the Jewish people, I'm told, have a, I don't know if legend is the right word or not, but the idea, the belief that this rock, I don't know how big the rock was, that Moses struck and out of it came water, that rock moved with them as they went across the wilderness. And when they were at a place where there was no water, the rock was there and the rock was used. Where did the Jewish people get that idea? Not from this. Because the Jewish people aren't reading this. This is a New Testament book. Okay? Perhaps Paul is mentioning that because they're familiar with that. Perhaps that really is what happened. I don't know. Are you okay with that big rock following them around? Don't bother me. All right? I don't know. what it is. I just know that it's a type, and that type is Christ. Okay. The other thing we might want to point out just for a minute is in verse 2. All were baptized into Moses. And when we think of the word baptized, we think of either the evangelical means of immersion in water, or the Catholic or Protestant, some Protestant revert methods of sprinkling. We think of that baptism in that way. What is the word I'm looking for? Sacrament. It's the sacrament of baptism. Okay. Just remember this. Not all baptisms are wet. In fact, somebody mentioned a name, 6 or 7 different baptisms in the New Testament. Only one of them involves water. All right, the others are different kinds of baptism. Baptism of the Holy Ghost. Baptism of John the Baptist. The baptism of Jesus. The baptism unto Moses, the baptized for the dead, and I think it's whatever book that's in, Hebrews perhaps, or somewhere later on in the New Testament. Different kinds of baptism. What does this mean? It says they were all baptized into Moses. This is not the sacrament of baptism. It is an identification. You see, when those children of Israel, when God parted the sea, for them to be willing to step out and walk across that seabed takes a committing yourself unto someone's leadership. And who was that? Moses. That took a decision, a serious decision. We identify ourselves with this man, trusting that he is leading us according to God's direction. And we commit ourselves to his leadership. They were baptized into Moses. So here are these things. You see, they've got them listed there on the outline. Now, point number 4 that's on the back page of your outline. Here's where it starts to get a little sticky. Here's the statement. A person may taste of the type, but never possess the antitype. Okay? A person may taste of the type, but never possess the antitype. How many of the children of Israel do you think ate the manna? Probably every one of them. Beverly, go ahead. Antitype? Yes. A person may taste of the type, but never possess the antitype. All of the children of Israel ate the manna. All of the children of Israel drank from that rock that represented Christ. But notice what in 1 Corinthians he says in chapter 10, verse 5. But with most of them, God was not well pleased. For the first time that I remember this past week, I noticed one word there. It's the word most. I knew the text said God was not well pleased with them, but I never sunk in that he had the word most there. With most of them, or many of them, God was not well pleased. Notice what it says, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. The fact that God was not well pleased with them is because they left behind them a trail of carcasses, a trail of graves. Yes, they had drank of the rock. They had ate the manna. But God was not satisfied with them. Verse 6. Now these things became our examples to the extent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Now notice this list he's fixing to give us. Do not become idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Neither let us commit adultery or sexual immorality as some of them did. And in one day, 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them did, and were destroyed by serpents. Nor complain, as some of them also complained, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now all these things, here's a warning for you. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the age have come. Therefore, let him that thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall. As a modern application of this text and of this trip across the Exodus, you can safely say that Christian churches in America have people who have tasted the benefits of a Christian life. They have tasted the benefits of Christian parents, of Christian Sunday school teachers, of faithful ministers, and yet their heart knows not the antitype Christ. Last week and this week, we looked at two types, the manna and the living water, the living bread and the living water. I want us to look at two scriptures in the New Testament that involve, each of them involve one of these things. I want to show you and point out to you the difference between someone who is a on the sidelines, someone who is just on the surface tasting these things, and someone who has really received them, someone who possesses them. The first one we're going to look at is with the manna, and this is John chapter 6. And I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this one because John talked about the manna last week. But in John chapter 6, Jesus, it's a long chapter, Jesus feeds the 5,000 with five loaves and two fishes. I got that right? It's not five fishes, two loaves. Is it five loaves and two fishes? He feeds them. They got 12 baskets left over of food. Jesus goes across to the other side of the sea that night. The next morning, people get up and he's gone. And they take the time to find him. They take the time to secure ships and boats and go across and find him. Why do they do that? They get over there and it seems like they're aggravated. They say, when did you come over here? Jesus tells them, you're looking for me not because I showed you a sign from God, but because you ate the bread and had your bellies filled. Free food. Potluck Sunday. They begin to ask him these questions that are goading him, it seems to me like, into doing this again. They say, what sign will you show us that we may believe you're the Christ? He just showed them one yesterday. Like, show us a sign of maybe making some more food. It says, our fathers gave us food from heaven. Show us a sign. Jesus tells them, I am the bread that comes down from heaven. I'm skipping a whole lot of stuff in here. You go back and read it. He goes on and tells them, I am the bread which came down from heaven. And they say, what? Who is this guy? Does it bother them that he is saying this? Yes, it does. They're not accepting what he's saying. They're not getting the point. They're just complaining, trying to find something wrong. They said, who is this guy that says, I am the bread comes down from heaven? He goes on and tells them a little later, the bread that I give you is my life, it is my flesh. And that's a bad one. He's going to give us his flesh to eat. We're going to eat his flesh. Some of his disciples, the text says, this is a hard saying. This is hard to grasp. The text tells many of the disciples who were there, not the 12, but many of the people who were following him, turned and left. I'm out of here. You've heard me say this before. I know it's been probably a while since I've said it, so let's say it again. Jesus turns to his disciples and he says, will you leave also? How did Jesus say that? I don't think Jesus is pleading with them to stay with him. No. I think Jesus is saying it just like this. Hey guys, the door is open. You can leave anytime you want. Peter, if that's the gist of it, Peter says to him, this is a hard saying. Where are we going to go? Jesus says, I am the living bread. Few and far between were the people who ate of it. They saw it. They may have tasted it on the surface, but of those who actually partook of Jesus, not many. The second one we're going to talk about a little more at length is the rock, the living water. We're going to go to John chapter 4 to look at this one. Jesus meets a woman at the well of Sychar, the Samaritan woman. He goes there, and he's there waiting when she comes up. Now, you can read this whole story, and I encourage you to read this whole story and ask yourself a question. Did this woman become a believer? It is hard to imagine reading this story and coming to the conclusion this woman does not embrace Jesus Christ. She does. It seems obvious that she does. So, I'm going to assume that she becomes a believer. If that is the case, then at some point prior to the end of this story, here's what has to happen. In her heart, God has to take her stone, cold, dead heart and give it life. I don't know when God does that, but he has to do it before the end of the story. He might do it that very day. He might have done it 3 weeks ago. He might have done it 6 months ago. I don't know. But at some point in the past, God has worked in this woman's heart and created in her a thirst, created in her a deep sense of needing forgiveness, needing cleansing. And it is, I don't want to use the word tormenting her, but it is always there. And she wants deliverance. She wants something that she knows not what she wants. And she comes to this well, and Jesus is sitting there. And Jesus tells her, will you give me a drink? And the woman, I don't know how she says this, and it really doesn't matter to the story, but perhaps you know the Jews and the Samaritans hate one another, and the Jews are afraid they're going to be defiled if they touch a Samaritan or anything that a Samaritan touched. They would avoid going through where Jesus is at. so they wouldn't have to deal with them. But Jesus goes that way. It's the shortest way, and he has a reason to go that way. And he asks her for a drink, and she says, and I'm going to assume she says it kind of picking at him a little bit. The truth is often spoken in jest, is a little saying that you've heard. She says, what do you mean? You asking a Jew, you're a Jew asking me, a Samaritan, to give you a drink? Aren't you afraid you're going to get the cooties? That's a paraphrase. The text doesn't say that. Aren't you afraid you're going to get your hands defiled and get yourself nasty dealing with me? Perhaps she says it sarcastically. And Jesus tells her, if you knew. And those three words change the course of this conversation. If I'm talking to you and I say, if you only knew this, such and such. When I use those words, if you knew, immediately you begin to examine what I'm fixing to say to see if you do know. So she's listening. But what does he say? If you knew who it was that said to you, give me to drink, you would have asked him for a drink. He would give you living water. Now the woman's got three choices at that point. The first choice is this. This guy is an idiot. If I knew who he was, and I would have asked him, what does he think? Who does he think he is? She doesn't buy that line of reasoning. She could look at it and say, boy, he's arrogant. What arrogance is coming from this guy? And dismiss what he says. She doesn't do that. Her only other option is that somewhere inside her, this longing to be forgiven is stirred up again. You would ask me, Jesus says, to give you to drink, and I would give you living water. And she knows I want that. This is something I need. And it starts to stir up a little bit of hope within her that this longing she has might be satisfied. She says, sir, the well is deep. You don't have anything to draw with. How are you going to give me this water? She's still a little confused about the connection between this longing inside of her and this real physical water here. Jesus tells her, person drinks from this water will come again. They'll thirst again. But if you drink of the water that I give you, you will never thirst. I don't know how this woman responds, but I think I do. I think her hope becomes stronger. The hope that she sees causes her inwardly to run to him. Not outwardly, but it causes her to come out with these words, sir, give me this water. And then Jesus says something that slaps her in the face. Jesus says something that jolts her to her senses with a single sentence. It was not unkind. It was not mean. Jesus never said anything to this woman that was mean. Still, it must have hit her like a ton of bricks, like a slap in the face, because it exposed her most serious failing. It exposed her deep guilt when Jesus says these words, "Go, call your husband, and come back." I think this woman probably stiffened as if a sudden pain had caught her. I think she was jolted and set back by a shock of her life. I think perhaps she grew pale as if she had seen a sudden apparition. And in truth, she has. Because she has suddenly caught sight of herself. If she does what Jesus says, go and call your husband, it will necessarily mean that she's going to expose her private life to this stranger. She doesn't want to do that. Perhaps she becomes a little sullen and withdrawn. I don't know. But while she is struggling with her emotions, Jesus further unmasks her with these words, or she answers his question, "I have no husband. I have no husband." Jesus further exposes her with these words. "You have spoken the truth. You have no husband, and the one that you now have is not your husband." Is there any doubt in your mind what Jesus is telling her? Is there any doubt in your mind what Jesus is accusing her of? Jesus is accusing her of an adulterous relationship with a man. Isn't he? Is there any doubt about that in your mind? There's not. How did this woman get to this place? How is it that she's been married 5 times? And now she's living with someone in an adulterous relationship. How did that come about? I don't know. I don't know the extent of how the society in her day that would come to pass. But I do know how it can come to pass in my day. Living together without being married, living together in an adulterous situation, is becoming more common and more common all of the time. How does that come about? I'm going to give you 4 or 5 ways that it happens. 4 or 5 ways that it is justified. Okay? Here's one. Susan's dad was a fireman at Little Rock. He retired from the fire department, got a pension check. When he died, his wife got his pension check. And she'll get his pension check until she dies. Unless she remarries. Okay? Would you believe that this happens? Some widow, her husband dies from the fire department, and she, you know, is single for a widow for 2 or 3 years, and then she decides she meets some guy and she wants to remarry. She knows. Once a year, she gets a piece of paper. Susan's mom gets one. And on that piece of paper, it says, "I, Eugene Ballard, am single." You know, I don't know what it says, but it has to be witnessed and notarized that say, "I am not married. I have not remarried." Okay? So, here's what happens. Believe it or not, this is what happens. People want to be married, but if they get married, they're going to lose the pension check. So what do? They live together. They live together in an adulterous situation for the sake of a pension check. Now, over the months, that adds up. Doesn't it? Okay? That's a pretty strong temptation. Here's another one. Single mom. She's 25 or 30 years old, single, got 3 or 4 kids. She gets a welfare check. If she remarries, the welfare check is going to change. So instead of getting remarried, she has a boyfriend, they just live together so that her welfare check remains as if she is single. Here's another situation that's becoming less common, but a woman is divorced. She has 3 or 4 kids. It doesn't matter if she has the kids or not, but let's say she does. She's getting a child support for her kids. She's getting alimony for her husband, for herself. If she gets remarried, the child support stays. The alimony disappears. So what does she do? They just live together so that she retains her alimony. Now, can you imagine an ex-husband paying alimony to support his ex-wife and her live-in boyfriend? The fact that she knows that gets his goat just makes it even more desirable, right? All right? I'm telling you facts, folks. I'm telling you the truth. This is the way it works. Let me tell you another situation. Two people are divorced. They've both been married before. And they find new boyfriends, girlfriends, significant others, whatever, soulmates, you know. And now they're wanting to get remarried. But, man, that divorce stuff is a hassle. That is a pain in the butt, right? It's costly. So we're going to see if this works. So we move in with each other and live together because of the risk involved in having to do this all over again. Or because it's so handy. An older couple in their 80s or 90s decide they want to get married. They have children that are 70 years old. They have grandchildren in their 40s or 50s. And they have a wealth of stuff that these children and grandchildren are expecting to get. All right? Y'all done went through these questions, haven't you? So what do? If they get married, they've got to go through all this legal stuff, making sure things and their kids are there watching, right? Okay, so it's easier just to live together. So what's the big deal? I'm going to tell you what the big deal is. It is the honor of God. And the fact that in our society, that is not a big deal. God's honor doesn't give a hoot. That's a big deal. Let me give you an example of how this works. My mother-in-law, Iva Jean, has dementia, has Alzheimer's. My mother had Alzheimer's. One of the hardest things to come to grips with is that they can't process information. They can't understand things that you think you ought to be able to explain to them. And it takes forever to just quit trying to explain to them the stuff. If my mother wants me to make sure I vote for President McKinley, then okay, I'll vote for President McKinley. All right? And we finally kind of, me and my sisters kind of finally came to that place with my mom that, you know, whatever she said, we went with it. You know, if there's a rabbit under the car, okay, there's a rabbit under the car. Whatever it is. Then she dies. A few months after that, Susan's mom is getting worse and worse and worse. And finally, she's kind of at that place. But she lives in our in the house with us. My mother wasn't just, she was across the road there. So we're seeing her every day. See, there's lots more opportunities for her to say something just off the wall that I need to correct. And I've not forgot this lesson I learned with my mom. And I remember particularly this one incident happened over and over and over. But I remember particularly this one time. She was sitting in her recliner, and I was sitting on the couch, and I was taking the time, which was rare, to just talk to her. And just talk about, you know, when she went to school at wherever it was, when she picked cotton, when she did this, things that she could remember. And we just talked about things she could remember. And I'd ask her about this person. If she couldn't remember that person, I'd find somebody she could remember. We'd talk about that person. But she was really enjoying the conversation. She liked those kinds of things. Susan was walking back and forth through the house, cleaning the house or whatever. I'm sitting there talking to her mom. Just all of a sudden, she says, "Now who are you?" I said, "Well, I'm John." Susan walks through. I said, "I'm married to her." Who's that?" She said, "That's Susan." So I'm married to your daughter, Susan. "Really? I didn't know y'all were married." I had to explain to her. Why I thought I needed to explain to her, I don't know. But it seems so easy to explain it. "You mean you've been living here for 9 years, and I'm coming in and out, we're both sleeping in that bedroom in there, and you don't know we're married?" "I didn't know. I know you've been coming and going a lot, but I didn't know you were married." I said, "We've been married for 39 years. We've been living together for 39 years. You didn't know we were married?" And about that time, it hits me. Just forget it. You know? She's got dementia. She doesn't understand. Listen to me. You don't have dementia. You don't. You don't have Alzheimer's. If I was to inform you right now that Susan and I were not married, you would not have the same reaction as her mom. No, it's not. What would you do? You would have some kind of reaction. Let me tell you what else would happen. The weight of my words would roll off you from now on like water off a duck's back, whatever the saying is. You would not listen to anything I had to say. Credibility. I'm going to word it a little stronger. In maybe not your heart, but I'm around more people than you. I go by people in the Walmart parking lot and in the aisles at Walmart or the lumber company or the grocery store. I pass them on the street. My world is filled with way too many people. Most of them I don't know. But I guarantee you I don't know of one person, whether I know them or not, that I'm not confident that this would happen. If I were to sit down and talk to them about God and Christianity and invite them to church and they begin to have a desire to look into this God thing with me, We've talked about our families. They know I'm married, or they know I've got kids. They know all these things. And they said, how long have you been married? I said, well, I'm not married. I'm just living with this woman. It's over. It's over. They're not listening anymore. The value that they put up on my Christianity is gone. And they are cursing my God in their heart. They may not say it outwardly, but they are mocking Him. Listen to me. The glory of God is of infinite more value than a pension check, than a welfare check, than your convenience. The glory of God, the honor of God, is of infinitely more value than those things. We are worshiping an idol. We have made a God that will suit us. He will put up with our sin. He will condone our sin. He's okay with us. You can tell, here's going to be my point of this whole thing here. I could tell someone that talked to them about living together. You know what will happen? They're going to get mad. They're going to say, it ain't none of your blanky blank business. Here's the truth. Whether it's any of my business or not any of my business is the least of their worries. Because it is some of God's business. I remember years ago talking to a guy about this very thing, and he said, John, he said, we've both been married before and divorced. We've been around the block. We know what's going on. What do you expect? It's not an issue of what I expect. The issue is, what does God expect? Now, I say all that just to say this. Jesus has just exposed this woman for this very thing, hasn't he? Does she get mad? Does he justify her actions? No. She runs to town here in just a little bit to tell all the other people with joy who she has found. Do you catch that? What is the difference? The difference is living water. She has tasted of the Lord, and He was good. This longing in her heart has been filled. This need for forgiveness has been experienced. This living water is Jesus. Well, this past week, actually 2 or 3 weeks ago, we started this study on Tuesday night. And pretty soon after I started it, and I was doing the homework in the book, looking up the verses and writing all the stuff, I was kind of in a hurry. I came across this question. The question said, are you willing to adjust, this is not exactly right, are you willing to adjust your life to anything that God may reveal of Himself to you this week? So I'm going to do my study. What's the answer to that question? What's supposed to be the answer to that question? Yes. So I got my pencil, and I'm fixing to scribble a yes out there, and I stopped. question doesn't ask me, should I be willing? The question is, are you willing? And there's a little hesitancy within my spirit. And I didn't like that. So I tried to push it out of the way. You know, there's no blank there, you know, I'm not going to write an answer there. It doesn't have a blank there, you know. So go on. Do you know every week in this study, they ask that same question? I think I'm going to put a piece of tape over it so I don't have to look at it. That's not funny. It's not. It's not funny. Because what I'm afraid is God may ask some changes of me that are not worth it. Now that is foolish. That is stupid. We'll leave you with this question. Do you want living water? Do you want it? I know you ought to want it. I know I ought to want it. But do you want it? I think you can see by now, this is the last point on the outline. If you do, then probably Jesus is going to say to you, go call your husband. He's not going to mean those words. He's going to mean deal with your sin. Your sin? My sin. Let's pray.